Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today to talk about the newest film by Terrence Malick, we have benevolent Lord and Master, Jordan Rout.
Hello, glad to be here.
We also have sometimes reoccurring guest, former full-time co-host, I don't know, he's a man of mystery, Nick Newman.
Podcasting. It's what I'm here to do.
I am looking forward to your impression of Antonio Banderas in this movie, taking the place of the enigmatic Spaniard.
You know, I've done it before. I actually did it when the trailer premiered all the way back in December of 2014.
Oh, I know. I remember.
Oh, okay.
But you, if you remember, did the Javier Bardem voice all the time. So I'm expecting repeat performances.
Yes, yes.
Excellent. Well, there's really nothing else to talk about. We've talked about Terrence Malick before, so we're all pretty much up to date on our feelings on him. And we talked about 10 Cloverfield Lane on the previous podcast, which is most likely being released before this one. So if you somehow missed that, make sure to dig in. This will hopefully be a less contentious podcast, because much as with Triple Nine, there were shouting matches during 10 Cloverfield Lane's podcast. And as fun as that may sound, I don't enjoy it. It is 100% annoying. So, I'm looking forward to a spirited conversation filled with brotherly love today. Let me remind everyone that they can follow us on Twitter, at @FilmStageShow. You can also find the posts that these shows are marked under on thefilmstage.com. You can email us a podcast at thefilmstage.com. And of course, you can give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. I believe that is it so far as preamble goes. Nothing else really to talk about. So let's do it. Let's dive right in. Here is the trailer for Knight of Cups, the newest film by Terrence Malick.
All those years, living the life of someone I didn't even know.
Let me tell you about you. I want to make you rich.
You see the palm trees? They tell you anything's possible.
No one cares about reality anymore.
Different these days. What's going on with you?
I can't remember a man I wanted to be.
Just don't threaten me with leaving, okay? Just do what you want to do.
So I kind of just want to let that entire trailer run in its entirety, because this is going to tip my hand as to what I felt about the movie. I'm eager to see this film again, and I will take as close as I can get, and that trailer is it for now. Does anyone know why this particular film, unlike To the Wonder, is not getting a day-and-date release on VOD?
Yeah, well, the distributor, Broadgreen, they didn't, you know, want to do that, so it's pretty much that easy. Magnolia does that a lot, and they don't really do it. So.
That's ballsy for Broadgreen.
You think so?
I think so. I feel like if people saw To the Wonder in any great numbers, it was because of the ease of access. And, for instance, I live in D.C., and there's one theater in the entire city that's showing this film. So
yeah,
I feel like
that's normal for like a limited release rollout, though. It's only the second week.
Not really. Not around here, anyway.
Because you, yeah. Anyways,
we have a bunch of independent theaters. I was expecting it to be in at least two, but no, nope, only one. So if you're in DC, head out to Landmark E Street and see Knight of Cups. But let's just move on. Let's talk about what we thought of the film. Jordan Rout, why don't you kick us off?
Sure, yeah. So, obviously, like any Malick movie, this has been a long time in the works.
Should we say what the plot is? Does it matter?
I could give a brief...
I was going to say, the movie follows Rick, who is apparently a screenwriter in Hollywood, as following an earthquake, he kind of negotiates the emotional landscape of his life through his relationships with a series of women.
Yep.
Does that sound about right?
Yeah. And his past, I would say, as well. His
yes.
family. Yeah.
Well, this movie is pretty hardcore with both portraying the act of remembering and the concept of memories intertwined with what could be a present day account of action.
Mm-hmm.
So to try to make a delineation of past and present in this particular film to me feels like folly. But Jordan Rao, what did you think of this movie? I apologize. Yeah. I've been looking forward to this all week.
Oh, no, not a problem. So as a fan, even up to The Wonder, which I believe I also saw with Nick, I didn't quite know what to think of that at first. And then I kind of have grown to love it since. And this movie, kind of on first viewing, I got out, and Nick can attest to this. It was almost like a disorienting experience. Once again, Malick working with Lubezki kind of plunges you into this memoryscape, if you will. And it's really unlike, you know, any other movie I imagine will get released this year. And he just does it in such a way that is quite beautiful. I will agree, you know, the first, when I saw it, it did feel, you know, slightly repetitive with the themes it was bringing up and things like that. But I did really find a lot to like here. And since revisiting it, I've revisited it once. And it's one that I will definitely keep rewatching. I found a lot to like in it. I don't know how much we want to get into at the start. But yeah, overall, I'm definitely positive. And I think Malick pushing forward with kind of removing, I think he could have even removed more dialogue in this movie and it would have worked even better. There's some lines from Wes Bentley that I didn't really love and things like that. In terms of pushing forward kind of what they're trying to do in these, or what Malick is doing specifically in these latest films, I think it really works well. And obviously it's not to the liking of a lot of people, but I really appreciate it. And yeah, so overall I thought it was quite a beautiful film, if slightly repetitive. Probably not up there with my favorite Malick movies, but one that I think rewards more on repeat viewings, kind of like To the Wonder. So yeah, that's a basic synopsis for me.
Nick Newman, what about yourself?
See, the thing is, you guys don't want a podcast. You want a podcast experience. And so I feel like...
You are planning on actually not just speaking in Malick dialogue, correct?
Perhaps, but okay. The thing is, I mean, when you do a podcast, you know, sometimes it's like raspberries, and then other times you want strawberries. So... I saw, you know, I have this problem where I can't remember who I was or the man I wanted to be, but then...
I was about to say, you know, this whole podcast, it feels like I've been podcasting as a host that I don't remember.
Well, for me, podcasting, it's kind of like playing Call of Duty on easy. I just go around and fuck shit up.
Oh my god, can we talk about how weird and wonderful it is to see Terrence Malick films nowadays that have, like, modern technology and modern things in them?
It's like Thomas Lennon.
Like Tom Lennon. He has a line in this movie where he says, "It's not just the pollution. It's cold and it's full of sharks." I've lived in LA for like 4 years. I've been to the beach 3 times. And I'm just like, I just love it. Like, there's so much dialogue that isn't in this movie or is completely unintelligible. And Malick heard that and was like, yeah, let's keep that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. So.
And that was Ron Swanson who said the Call of Duty easy mode thing.
Yeah, Nick Offerman.
That's right. Nick Offerman shows up. Joe Latrulio briefly appears. It's pretty amazing.
Oh, Jason Clark is in this too, isn't he?
For, I believe, one shot. Also, Joe Manganiello from the Magic Mike series.
Oh, he is.
Who Antonio Banderas says, "You are fantastic."
Someone just saw Magic Mike XXL.
Yeah. And his response is just, "Thank you." Which, Okay.
Now I'm thinking of Tony. I'm thinking of Antonio Banderas being in like Magic Mike XXXL, I guess. That doesn't seem like a far shot, does it? He could be in that.
Oh, it could happen, yeah.
He should be in that. Let's say that. Anyway, Nick Newman.
Will they get Emmanuel Lubezki to photograph? I feel like that could be really interesting.
Terrence Malick will actually direct Magic
Mike
XXX.
So I don't think I have a ton of time here, so maybe I should actually review the movie.
Possibly.
So yeah, I saw Knight of Cups with Jordan. We sat next to each other during the movie. I'm sure there's some sort of mental transmission going on there, but Jordan can attest that I laughed quite a lot during this movie at times when it might have even seemed inappropriate. However, the laughing was not derisive. It was not against the film. It was very much with the movie, which for me works best when it's kind of playing as this spiritual comedy about the absurdity of Los Angeles. And I think Malick's very self-aware, winking at the audience, for even further transition into the contemporary world, which he had flirted with in The Tree of Life. He had thrown himself into the wonder, and here I think he's submerged in even more, because if this is not set in Paris and Oklahoma, this is set in Los Angeles, which, as the movie will tell us, as it'll reveal to us as a shocking truth, is not always such a nice place. And I found myself very much with the movie for pretty much the entire runtime, really. I think that the film does start to perhaps repeat itself, or it begins shifting its focus towards territory that's not as interesting, but towards the end. But I guess I sort of have this thing where maybe this means I'm biased, maybe this means I can't review the movie quote-unquote objectively, but I just have this sort of endless fascination with the Malick Lubezki way of photographing and capturing the world, particularly capturing our world, and making all of these things, even something as sad and unappealing as a Las Vegas strip club, seem interesting and cosmic. And, there's been a discussion surrounding this movie that I've found interesting and I think valuable, which is the question of, is this movie sexist? Does it have sort of a kind of a stale perspective in that it's about a man's search for himself, and part of his search for himself is sleeping with beautiful women and cavorting around with them and driving in his convertible with them, as some of the movie's most beautiful shots will attest to. I just got a big smile crack across my face when it's kind of those low angle, wide angle shots of the women in the car. Do you know what I'm talking about? Right at the beginning of the film. Yeah, because again, it's kind of this thing where it's something that I think on its own would just kind of be a bit boring and familiar. And here it feels cosmic. It feels elevated. And I think that the question of, is this sort of a stale narrative? Perhaps it is on the surface, but I would say more than anything, it's just a bit familiar. And I think it really counts for something that they are using images to make it feel new, to make it feel different. And so it becomes kind of this strange spiritual journey towards learning one's identity through the lens of an episode of Entourage, essentially. Or, considering the length, maybe a condensed season of Entourage, or Entourage the movie.
You know what's funny? Everyone keeps saying Entourage. No one on Earth seems to be bringing up Californication.
No, Dan Mecca did his first tweet. He was the first one I saw bring it up.
Okay, because you're talking about a lone writer sleeping with a bunch of different hot women.
Mm-hmm.
But he has an attachment to them. That's Hank Moody. I mean, Vinny Chase, he had sex with a lot of women, but he never really thought about them. And he was also surrounded by four sycophants.
That's a fair point. However, nobody has ever seen a full episode of Californication.
I sadly have.
I've seen almost all of them. I did not like the last season where he had an illegitimate son. But
let's move past that. Yes.
Welcome to Californication cast.
All right.
Cast of Fornication.
But the thing is, for me, part of what makes this movie really interesting is how it values every perspective that it has an opportunity to mine. And I think it, through things that are perhaps a bit heavy-handed, such as the tarot cards, for instance, it says that, as was the case in something like The Tree of Life, that everything is connected to everything and everything has an impact on something. And I found the movie's kind of using Christian Bale's Rick, this disaffected writer, as kind of the rock around which this ocean is kind of constantly revolving and swimming, to be effective insofar as it used its elements well. I do think that something such as the storyline involving his brother and his father. All right. I mean, I like Brian Dennehy a lot, but I don't really need to see the scenes where he's going around afflicted with Alzheimer's, it seems, because I feel like that doesn't really tell us anything that we haven't seen. And I feel like we can just sort of instead spend time with, you know, this very beautiful vision of Los Angeles. But it all feels like it's part of a continuum. It all feels like it's part of the same piece. And I have to take it as a whole, don't I? And so in that sense, I guess I'm okay with it. Overall, yeah, I mean, I like Knight of Cups. I think that it has sort of this quality of making the world seem new. And that's more than I can say for really most films that I see ever, making the world really seem new. And I also think that it's, you know, I mean, one thing that's interesting to me is that I think the movies, we can get into this if we get into spoilers. The idea of spoilers for Knight of Cups is kind of funny to me, but
hilarious. But yeah, I think there will
don't,
be a point.
Don't reveal who the sixth girl is, guys.
I think it's interesting how the movie's emotional climax, or at least its high point, is from a female perspective, and it relates to an experience that is exclusively, explicitly female, let's say.
Yes.
And how I think it wants to, how I think, again, how he is the one who's at the center of it and everything is swirling around him. And that means that there are going to be things that push and pull. And the way that he kind of has to re-examine himself because of this. And the scene involves Natalie Portman, I should say. And she gives, at this point, a very physical performance. One that is not just a matter of crying, but also kind of being very forceful and standing by herself. And if this is a movie that is about people trying to connect to each other, sometimes trying to connect to each other in a very intimate physical way, that to me felt like perhaps the most powerful gesture in the entire movie was that moment there. So I think that, you know, it's, is it another story of a straight white man who's sad and he's sleeping with beautiful women? Sure. But it's that as a start, I think. I think it gets into more than that. And yeah, so overall, I liked it a fair amount. It's not my favorite film of his by any means, but I would not be surprised if it grows on a second viewing. I look forward to a second viewing. Yeah, so those are just some thoughts on Cock, K-O-C, you know?
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God. Let's not have that be a thing.
Before I saw this movie, I actually planned on tweeting about to get a face full of K-O-C. But the movie was about to start.
Oh, so yeah, I remember that.
You couldn't tweet it out fast enough.
Not quite. No, it would have been rude.
What a shame.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now that we're recovering from that, Knight of Cups. I really, really enjoyed this film. Malick has been moving more and more towards abstraction of narrative and story and plot. I don't believe there is a plot in a traditional sense to this film. I do believe there is a story, so, you know, break out your dictionary and figure out the difference between those two things. I can't explain what it is about a Malick film that makes it so impressive and makes it so hilarious to watch people who haven't been there through the evolution of his storytelling attempting to grapple with it. For instance, this is the screening that I have been to. I went to a critic screening, but, you know, people lined up for an hour or two beforehand to get to see this early. And people were walking out left and right. And at the end of the movie, if you've never been to a press screening before, two interns or staffers will stand outside with pads of paper soliciting from people what their thoughts on the film were and then jotting them down. What they do with those snippets, I have no idea. People were walking up to these two poor staffers and literally saying out loud, what was it? What did it mean? Tell me what it's about. Like, begging for an answer from these two people who probably didn't even watch the film. They were just standing outside. And when I try to explain to people what it is about a Terrence Malick film that really makes it one of the more transformative cinematic experiences that you can go through, I say that he is like a harpist who sits before the harp and plucks strings seemingly at random, and people are watching him pluck and listening to the plucked strings, and then failing to realize that the music is going to come from the echo of those strings once he's done. His are the few films where I wish I could go into them for the first time, having already seen them one time before. I would love to be able to, in an instant, gain the whole of the experience of the film at the onset of watching it for the first time. Because it really is the type of thing where understanding the flow and where it's going will help you in understanding where it is going in the moment. Walking out of this film, I had the music stuck in my head. If you find the Knight of Cups soundtrack, Exodus is this, I think it's a flute or an oboe. It's a low woodwind that's on the back of some, it's possibly a harp, I don't know, some plucked strings that are being played. And it's utterly beautiful, and it's playful and inquisitive, and it's exactly what you'd want playing over your own life during the moments when you are moving between things, because it gives a sense of purpose to the nothingness in between the moments of your life. So that's playing in my head, and then you just start to look at the world differently. Malick and Lubezki have a way of pulling from banal existence angles and objects and juxtapositions that draw out from everyday existence the utter beauty and majesty of being. In my new house, I have my study set up on the second floor in the far back corner, and I have a window that looks out at a tree that is covered in dead vines. I guess at some point the tree was about to be killed by this vine and people finally decided to do something about it. And we're at the onset of spring. There's still no blossoms or shoots on the tree. But the tree is obviously healthy. The vine is obviously dead and probably has been for over a year. And it's raining and there's water dripping from the dead vine onto the tree and then just cascading down the trunk. And it's the type of thing that you almost wouldn't realize if you weren't primed to realize it by talking about or having seen a film like this. It like opens you up. And that's before you even get into the narrative that's going on. It's a singular experience that it is upsetting to consider certain people will not give the time and attention necessary to. I realize that everything I've just said has very little to do with the content of the film, but that's just kind of how Malick is. I think that a lot of the performances in this film are fantastic. I think that the way the film is set up is deceptively well thought out. I'm working on something that'll appear on the film stage that gives a rundown of what each tarot card referenced before each section means and how it relates to that section, because my fiance has actually studied tarot, and when she was explaining it to me, it becomes clear that he's not just choosing these things because they sound cool, but he's actually attempting to give more information to people who again are willing to look for it. So yeah, I loved this film. I am looking forward to making it out to that one lone theater in DC that's playing it to see it again. And you're going to see things in this movie that you're not going to see anywhere else, in ways that you'll never see them anywhere else. And yeah, that's it. There's nothing else to say, really.
I found it kind of an
experience.
I was going to say, I don't know if you guys agree with this, but I actually talked to Jack Fisk, the production designer, and I thought it was a pretty great interview, which you can read on the film stage. But one of the films that kind of transformed, you know, actually got him into the interest in filmmaking was Red Desert. Mm-hmm. I know Nick turned me on to that film a few years back, but and I thought there was some kind of connection here, whereas this is the first Malick movie where the world he's capturing almost feels oppressive, whereas in almost every other film, it's he's made, I think he's trying to show the beauty in things, and he definitely does so here. But overall, I think different things he adds, whether it's the earthquakes or the planes flying overhead and clearly going after that, and even the maybe it has to do with more what he's capturing. Aside from the stuff in the desert, which he was akin to kind of the Sean Penn sequences, I would say in Tree of Life. I don't know if you guys saw that too and agree with it, or if that's maybe why it's what turning people off a little bit. There's kind of something a little like unsettling underneath what he's capturing, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I think Antonioni is such a big part of my brain. I kind of see him in almost anything I watch, but that was kind of, yeah, no, I mean, Red Desert certainly does come to mind. I think that kind of the Sturm und Drang of the modern world, quote unquote. What was the modern world for Antonioni in the mid-60s in Italy, and what is the modern world for Malick in, I guess, technically 2012, but, you know. I mean, I don't know if you guys noticed, there's a billboard for the Oliver Stone movie Savages in this film.
And Total Recall as well, the remake.
Total Recall, yeah. And I don't know, I mean, I'm not sure if... Because I noticed that the reception to this is probably as mixed as it was for To the Wonder. And perhaps there's something to be said for the fact that, how would I put this? So let me phrase this through a tweet. On Twitter, Jamie Chrisley, who's sort of like a film guy on Twitter, said that it's interesting how the sort of conversation around Malick and film culture in 5 years has gone from, you know, shh, the master speaketh, to, you know, put a sock in it, old man, basically. How once he's kind of started revealing more of himself, people seem to kind of back away a bit, which I find interesting.
That is interesting, because one of the things that I've liked so much about To the Wonder and Knight of Cups now is how much of himself there feels like it feels as though he is putting into them.
Yeah.
He had a stately rigidity to himself previously that he's done that, you know, Days of Heaven, Badlands, The Thin Red Line, The New World. They're great. I love them. But it was hard to feel him feeling anything through these stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so with To the Wonder and now Knight of Cups, it's like shocking to see that he has passion, and, you know, given the male gaze in both films, that he apparently might have, you know, some sense of eroticism. Yeah, it's not what you're expecting from Terrence Malick.
Mm-hmm.
I've loved that. I've loved seeing that. You know, it's sort of the same concept, obviously, but not the same extent as Wolf of Wall Street, where, you know, we've watched a couple of pretty easy genre exercises and stately Oscar grabs from this aging director. And then suddenly you get a shot of adrenaline in the heart, or, you know, to be more apt with the Wolf of Wall Street, you know, a giant snort of cocaine, and you see them kind of cut loose again. And seeing Terrence Malick, of all people, cut loose is pretty fucking wonderful.
Yes. While also being, I think, you know, very self-critical too. And by the way, we haven't brought up, well, this reminds me, the fact that, okay, so there's a cameo in this movie from Dan Harmon, who is the creator of the since-canceled show Community, right? Yes,
and co-creator of Rick and Morty.
Co-creator of Rick and Morty. I did not know that.
Fantastic.
So he's in this movie, and he has a close-up, and Christian Bale's character Rick is in a writer's room with him, which might mean that this is about a disaffected womanizing Community writer. Which I find very interesting, because it's also this thing about how, you know, to what extent is he being Malick, asking us to identify immediately with these famous faces and kind of graft what we know of and assume about them onto these kind of blank presences, and how much is it supposed to just be a matter of a certain authenticity? Perhaps his, you know, casting director or whoever was kind of pulling these people in. But I don't know, kind of the nebulous space this movie occupies between a very extravagant and realistic portrait of Los Angeles and sort of this hollowed out fantasy land is worth asking. I mean, for instance, there's this big party scene in the movie where this guy asks Christian Bale's character if he's ever done ketamine. And that guy is Bruce Wagner, who wrote David Cronenberg's Maps to the Stars.
Really?
Yes, it is.
How do you know that?
Because I
knew this photo.
I had heard he was in the movie, and I don't exactly remember what Bruce Wagner looks like, but the second he showed up, I went, oh, that's him. And you know, Bruce Wagner has made an entire career out of writing about the supposed, deadening, the supposed beating, awful heart of Hollywood. So there are kind of all these weird ins and outs of the movie. Also with the fact that, for some reason, all the people at the party seem to be involved in the comedy world, in acting and writing. And he is supposedly a comedy writer, despite being perhaps the most somber character in a Terrence Malick film ever, which I find very funny. In and of itself, I find that very funny.
Well, comedians are usually pretty sad people.
That's true, but this is a guy who looks like he's never even heard a joke before. I mean, it's seriously, you know. He smiles, I can think of maybe one time in this movie he smiles, and it's a shot that's in the trailer when he's at the aquarium, right?
Yeah.
Just kind of a strange scene. So, by the way, that reminds me, actually, what do you guys think of the sort of... What do you guys think is Terrence Malick's deal with, like, deformed people? I find that very interesting, because that's...
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, because, I mean, we saw it in Right to the Wonder, and... What else? Tree of Life, yeah, to an extent. I just think he's trying to juxtapose the extreme opposite of the world that, you know, because throughout pretty much every scenario except the one with Cate Blanchett, he's going after something that's of the utmost beauty and things like that. And then with Cate Blanchett, she's the only kind of character that seems completely grounded in, quote unquote, a Christian ideal or more religious ideal of what, you know, of what life means. And so I think that's, like, he's just showing the polar opposites.
Yeah. Some people, I mean, there were a couple of people who have said that this is kind of... People have been saying this, I think, since To the Wonder, that there's something kind of offensive about this, that they think that he's kind of aestheticizing deformities and aestheticizing ugliness, which I don't really agree with, because I don't think it's... Perhaps he's aestheticizing it, but I don't think he's...
It would be different if he wasn't like every shot in his movie is aestheticizing the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think he's, exactly creating a freak show here.
I did love how, to your point, where I don't think I've ever seen a Los Angeles movie that kind of goes down to downtown LA and has shots of, you know, people playing whatever game, dominoes or whatever it was, I forget.
Yeah, it was
and like kind of seeing kind of like, I don't, you know, the more, you know, lower class level of LA. And I just thought that was really fascinating how, you know, when people say, you know, Terrence Malick made a movie about Hollywood, it's really, even the sets, you know, it's not like Hail Caesar, you know, even the Warner Brothers set is like completely vacant.
It's kind of funny you say that, because I'm pretty sure he walks by a building that was in Hail Caesar.
Yeah.
That kind of like City Hall looking place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I liked how he kind of took what you thought a Hollywood movie would be and then sucked out everything Hollywood, and then maybe perhaps besides from the party scene, in terms of the movie making side.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the first movies I've seen that actually makes me want to go to Los Angeles, despite depicting it as a broken, barren place. I did think he can't help but make it look beautiful, you know? Which I think is kind of funny. I would also recommend, I took a friend of mine who's from Los Angeles to see this movie, and through a lot of the movie, he would just kind of chuckle when a specific location showed up, because of the way that this captures the city in kind of this new way, where it's showing all these things that you don't normally see. So if you live near a friend who is from Los Angeles, take them to see this movie, and they'll probably have a great time. They'll probably get an additional something out of it. They can tell you what building that's shown briefly their father used to work in. So, you know, there's also that much.
Well, did we want to get into spoilers? I mean, again, we didn't. I don't know how to define spoilers in this film, but there were certain things that had been said during our individual points.
Yeah,
that I wanted to explore. So let's not call it spoilers. But let's say We're going to be discussing, now that we've talked about this movie in a more ethereal way, some particular aspects of the narrative. So if you got a problem with that, go see the movie first. But I'm not going to split this out into a spoiler section. So Nick Newman, let's talk about Wes Bentley.
Yeah. He just wants to feel something.
This is in the section called The Hanged Man.
Oh, yeah. This movie is divided into sections, which I didn't really find an effective structuring technique myself.
Well, hopefully the thing that I'm working on with my fiance will help you to understand better what it is. At least it'll give some interesting context. You might not want it more.
Your thing with your fiance?
I had said earlier that we are writing a article that will appear on the film stage this week that's going to look into the meanings behind what the cards mean and what they relate to their section.
Yeah, I would like someone to tell me that this is an effective structural technique, because it was the thing about the movie that probably bothered me most and most contributed to kind of the herky-jerky pacing rhythm of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So
I liked it in the moment, I think, just aesthetically, but the more, like, this is how this movie operates on like a primal level. I got home, I sat downstairs, I'd had a drink, and I thought that my fiance had gone to bed. And meanwhile, when I come upstairs, she's sitting on the bed with the tarot cards out in the sequence that they'd been in the movie, flipping them and looking up their numerical values and like figuring out exactly what they meant. And the more she learned about it and the more she talked about it, the more enthusiastic she got. So I think that this will be the type of thing that helps not to appreciate the movie in general, but just to find another level of it to appreciate. Because even without knowing it, because I don't know shit about tarot, yeah, I was all about this movie. But a lot of this
gets
pretty interesting.
Just so we're clear, she saw the movie, right?
Yes, she was there with me in the critic screening.
I thought what you had said, I thought you went to go see the movie by yourself. You came home and your fiance had these cards.
No.
Just happened to be the exact sequence.
That would be so creepy.
Here's the thing. I don't believe in like any of that stuff, and I don't really have an interest in it. But if that happened, I got to say,
suddenly Nick's a believer.
The skeptic's mind would be intrigued.
Right. And it's interesting to consider, because even if you don't believe in them as like a tool of divination, you know, you can't deny that somewhere out there people have attached value to them. And Malick using them as such actually is pretty interesting. Here's a brief preview. For instance, the moon is the first one that we get. Imogen Poots plays an actress that Rick is with. And that card apparently underscores the way a person connects emotionally with others. And that is the period in which Imogen Poots says, you don't want love, you want a love experience. So the card underscores her purpose in this journey of self-discovery that Rick is going through. And if it's an emotionally stable person, the moon is usually incredibly positive. If they're not, then it's a super negative thing. And obviously that's what this is going through. So it'll be things like that. And, you know, it's like I said, it's not important to know it to understand the movie, but it definitely is the type of thing that people looking to mine more from this already incredibly rich film would probably be interested in learning.
Yeah, I definitely will read that. Sweet. I mean, I will have to read it because I will edit it. But if I didn't, I would surely read it.
Even if I wasn't. Yeah. It's not going to get as many hits as my 10 Cloverfield Lane piece. But
yeah, that is blowing up.
Sweet. You know, I couldn't look at that because I'm trying to avoid spoilers for 10 Cloverfield Lane before I see it.
Well,
so in this case,
check it out.
Yeah, you're ready for a treat. Were you guys kind of caught off guard at all by the ending? Like, how I thought it was a little abrupt.
Oh, I thought we were still talking about 10 Cloverfield Lane.
No, we're not.
This, a little bit, I guess. It's hard. It's always hard to know in a Malick film. And in fact, I remember at some point thinking, okay, the movie's going to end now. And then it continued on for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, the exact same thought. I think when he was like in the wilderness kind of walking around, I was like, oh, this will be the last shot. And then it's like,
and then it's like, nope, here we are. Who? This is a pointless question that doesn't mean anything, but I'm curious. Who was the last woman he was with?
Isabel Lucas.
The one who was swimming in the pool naked?
I believe so, yes. There's that long, like one of the longest shots in the movie, actually, isn't it? From what I recall, there, yeah. Yeah, that's part of the reason why it felt so abrupt, because we didn't really get to know her at all. and then it ends.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't know. Was she the stripper?
No, Teresa Palmer.
She was just a completely new person.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought, but, you know.
Oh. I was just curious. Christian Bale only pushes one girl in a grocery shopping cart, and that is Teresa Palmer.
Yeah, I found that section, the High Priestess, to be one of my favorites.
Definitely has the most, going to Las Vegas. I did not expect that. I had no idea the movie even would go there. So
yeah.
I thought that was kind of interesting, the way they captured that.
Has the most Kevin Corrigan, too.
Yeah, for 4.5 seconds.
So. Ain't no problem with some Kevin Corrigan in my movie. What was it in particular about the Wes Bentley, interludes, Nick, that kind of drove you away from them?
It felt like the movie was kind of... How would I put this? As I've kind of talked about before with the movie's emotional logic, it felt like it was centering itself in sort of a dramatic conflict or an emotional turmoil that could already be discussed and explored through Christian Bale's character. I felt like it was kind of adding things onto the movie with regards to a strained relationship with his, ex-junkie brother that... I just didn't find really nearly as interesting when there are all these other things that could be explored with the relationships with the women and kind of wandering through the world, this very strange world, going to Hollywood parties, things of that sort. I think it's perhaps more than anything a matter of when it's juxtaposed, it feels particularly uninteresting to me. And I think that the whole thing with the father, who again is played by Brian Dennehy, and it's definitely implied that he has Alzheimer's or something of that sort.
When you're washing your hands with blood, you might not know what's going on.
That's true.
No.
Yes.
I definitely feel as though he had Alzheimer's. There's a particular point in this film where I think Christian Bale's character Rick says something along those lines, like,
yeah,
you know, his mind is slipping away, let him go with a little bit of dignity left.
Yeah. So with that in mind, I was a little ambivalent about it, because it kind of felt like, I don't know, to me it felt like an update, a follow through to the father-son conflicts in The Tree of Life, almost as if this is kind of what Sean Penn's character is experiencing now today with his own father, if that character were still alive, that is. So it's interesting for that reason, but I could not invest myself in it the way I could invest myself in kind of the floating freeform images nearly as much.
I was going to say every single, I think it's like the scene when they're in the house and then they're on top of a roof. Those are like the two main ones that I recall. And it's the one time in the movie where the movie slows down to literally show a scene, it feels like. So that could be it, partially. These things aren't really intercut with the rest of the film. It feels like it stops to focus on this. And yeah, I agree with you too about the Tree of Life connection with the brother who passed. I mean, in real life, he committed suicide, I think, Terrence Malick's brother, when he was young. And so that definitely feels like a follow through from Tree of Life. It did feel the most kind of, okay, we're doing this again kind of thing, and not in the sense that I learned any more about Christian Bale's character from it. The Wes Bentley, like that one line, I kind of cringed. I just want to feel something, man. It's just like, you don't need that. If, you know, he evokes everything he needs to in this space and things like that.
Yeah, I actually found his physical performance pretty interesting to watch when they're, was that his apartment? That like empty warehouse space?
Yeah.
First of all, that space probably is worth like $4,000 a month.
Yeah. I love the shot where he like, you can clearly tell like he kicks over the TV, or like he doesn't try to fully kick it over, and then he like runs after to pick it up, kind of. Do you guys remember that? It's just kind of like, I feel like he turned to Malick and be like, we're not going to have that in the movie, right?
No, of course not. One of the things, and in fact, speaking of that physical performance, one of the things that I love most about Terrence Malick films, especially now that we've got them kind of moving in the modern world, it sometimes feels really hard to tell who's an actor. For instance, when he goes to Las Vegas, he appears to be talking to a pimp
Oh, yeah.
I was like, did they just find that guy? Like, is he a real human being that they happened to see? And Terrence Malick was like, pull the car over. Chivo, get the camera. Let's do this.
I would not be surprised. Well, I mean, there's that story as well with Teresa Palmer, how Christian Bale just, you know, Terrence Malick was like, okay, here's the strip club. You're just going to go inside and talk to this stripper. And he did that, and he had no idea she was an actress.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's incredible.
And then they went on to shoot the other scenes with her, and he learned quite quickly. So I just thought that was... That just shows you how little regard Terrence Malick has for...
He didn't recognize her from I Am Number 4 and Warm Bodies?
I guess not. I just love how Terrence Malick could just, you know, barely give you anything ahead of time and then let it kind of flow.
No, there's a fantastic interview with Tom Lennon. I think it was on IndieWire.
Business Insider.
Business Insider. Yeah. And it was like all about, what's it like shooting a scene in a Terrence Malick film?
It was strange. I talked to the producers and I asked them about that specifically, and they kind of brushed me off because I was like, why? Because Thomas Lennon literally said it was like, he felt horrible the first few hours. Like, he had no idea. He was not prepped. And they said it was the most fun he's ever had on set. And they were just like, oh, we talked to all the actors that they're having problems. And then that's like the only answer they gave. I was hoping they would dive into it a little more, because obviously not everyone comes to a Malick film with the same, you know, preconceptions in mind, perhaps, or know what they're getting into.
No. And I think that a lot of audience members don't come to that in that way either.
Full circle. Yeah,
indeed. I don't know what else there is to say about this film.
You just got to experience it, man.
That's the thing, man. Like, I want to talk about this film, and we have, obviously. We've been talking for about 50 minutes, and, you know, we didn't have a preamble, so that's just about right. And it's just hard to know, like, it's one of those things where I just want to keep bounding around it and saying, what did you think of this scene, or how interesting was this shot? For instance, right after the earthquake, there's a scene of Rick outside alone, and in the background there's a group of people who are like consoling themselves and making sure each other are okay, and an aftershock happens and everyone lays down on the ground, and just there's something about that vision that's so outside of the cinematic norm.
Yes, that's so crazy you brought that up, because I literally, like, while I was watching that, I was like, this is amazing. Like, the camera swoops down, you're talking about, and it touches the knee to the ground. Yeah.
And you can see the people in the background doing the same thing. And it's just like it's this strange. And if you tried to make a movie that had this scene in it, it would be really difficult to do it as good as Malick does, where it's just a slice of life, but you also learn from it how disconnected this man is, even from a very universally human experience. There's an entire city that just had an earthquake, and he's still... seems like this lone wanderer who has no idea what's going on and can't reach out to anyone to understand. It's fantastic.
And I also love the many shots of him completely alone in his apartment and then just looking across and people in the apartment across from him having parties. And
and the repetition of, like, children this film.
Who, Shea Whigham has that he's in, like, I think for literally 0.2 seconds or two frames. There's like, he has a family and they like just moved into town. And there's like two kids running around. He's the dad in that scene. So
jeez.
This movie, even if you hate the movie, you can rewatch it just for a factor of guessing who's in it.
Look, I go through this movie like Call of Duty on easy mode.
Supposedly also there's a Malick cameo, which I know, Nick, you tried to ask if it's legit, but
yeah, and the guy never responded.
I know.
It's probably,
it looks like him obviously we don't know what it is. But I don't know. The shot, Brian, it's a shot. I don't know if you saw it on Twitter, but the shot where – the only really shot where you get someone making movies where he's on set and there's he's at the craft service table.
Oh, really?
And there's a cowboy that walks through. Supposedly that is Malick. So this could be another Thomas Pynchon thing, but where he's not actually in the movie or is, but Inherent Vice.
There was wasn't there a video of Terrence Malick like dancing with – Benicio del Toro or something?
Not dancing. Well, they were coming out of a restaurant, and TMZ picked them up, and TMZ had no idea it was Malick and didn't include it in the article at all. And everyone's like, holy shit.
There is a video on YouTube of him at some sort of country western bar dancing with his wife.
Oh, okay.
Oh, that might be it, yeah.
Yeah, I put those two things together.
It is funny to see. I mean, the day where the next movie, when the Waitlist, I guess, which is not the official title, but might be whatever. When it was revealed he was shooting, and there was just like a million high quality photos of him. It was just kind of this like rush where he doesn't care anymore, I guess.
Yeah.
So we'll see. Supposedly that movie, talking to the producers, is even crazier, and they said it's like a shot of adrenaline. So that's how they described it.
Because if I did have one, I won't even call this like a knock against the film, but if there was one thing that I was kind of a little disappointed in the trailer for this movie, it's very hyperkinetically edited. It's got this weird electro music in the background. And I was sort of wondering if this would be the movie that breaks Terrence Malick from his like purely classical soundtracks. And it didn't, but I loved it, so it's okay.
Well, even in the sense because the movie does set you up even in the beginning with that kind of avant-garde sequence with the in black and white and the women with the eye thing. And I was hoping the movie would kind of continue that kind of weird trajectory, but it doesn't. But
I think that if we got Terrence Malick to make a movie and then we got Shane Carruth to score it, that could be something really beautiful. Anyway, that's my final thought. There's a lot more to discuss and feel about this movie. I'm looking forward to writing and posting the article that I've talked about. So, ladies and gentlemen, make sure to look out for that on Twitter, Facebook, and the film stage itself. Gentlemen, were there any other thoughts or ideas we had about this movie we wanted to get out there before we say goodbye for now?
I really enjoyed it, and it definitely opens up more, I think, on second viewing. And if you find this kind of method addictive in the sense of you want to just keep, you know, watching it over and over again, this movie holds up in that sense.
Yeah, I cannot wait to see this again.
Yeah, if you're
Let's play a really dumb game. Who do you think Rick should end up with?
Is there going to be Knight of Cups to the Bachelorette?
Yeah.
Or the Bachelor, I guess.
Who should he give a rose to?
He should be lonely, I think, the rest of his life.
Standing at the beach, just all alone.
I think he should just, the shot with the dogs diving in the pool and trying to get the ball, he should just, be like Daniel Radcliffe in Trainwreck and just start a dog walking business with them.
That's fantastic. I'm okay with that idea. It's the movie that's so chock full of things to talk about that we have to just call it after we've given our ethereal emotional reactions. That is all for today. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Next week, we'll be talking about, I don't know, Jordan?
Midnight Special, you guys should see that if it opens near you. We probably won't be talking about it because it's limited release until April 1st.
I won't even have a screening of that until the week after next. So,
and also, if you're listening to this and live in New York and LA, see My Golden Days, which I think Nick can back me up on.
It's cool. I will this week have my interview with Arnaud Desplechin up. I've been waiting to share that for 5 months now. So, yeah. Excited to share that.
In terms of talking, it's unfortunately The Lobster got cut out of the release schedule a few weeks before it was going to come out. So,
is that a bad sign? Have we seen The Lobster?
No. Well, I think it's good for the film in the sense that the distributor was having financial trouble that had it, and they dropped it, and then A24 picked it up, they only picked it up 2 weeks before it was going to come out. So. They didn't want to rush it, I would guess. So
yeah, I'm sure that they'll try to do what they did with The Witch and actually put some marketing muscle behind it.
Yeah.
All right, well, God only knows what we'll talk about next week. The week following, however, will most likely be Batman versus Superman. So
yeah,
steel yourself for that. In the meantime, I really literally have no idea what we're going to talk about next week. So we'll probably find something on VOD. If anyone out there has any ideas of what they'd like us to watch, tweet at us at Filmstage Show. Till then, Jordan Raup, where can we find you on Twitter, Facebook, internet at large?
On the Filmstage every day, and then at JP Raup on Twitter. And another shout out to our Instagram, which we just launched, the Filmstage. So
awesome.
Go for it.
All right, Nick Newman.
You can find me thefilmstage.com, twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and driving through tunnels in Los Angeles, trying to figure out what kind of man I want to be.
I can't even remember the man that I wanted to be. Anyway, find me on Twitter, at Brian J. Rowan. Don't look for me on Facebook, I don't want to be your friend. And you can find all of my work related to the two big releases and the two podcasts that we've done. That's the 10 Cloverfield Lane piece looking at the original script and the tarot breakdown of Knight of Cups on thefilmstage.com. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Tune in next time.